Hello, listeners. It is March 16th, 2017. I'm Scott Bland, your host, and you are listening to Politico's Nerdcast. On this episode, which comes this week with a pun-free introduction, we have updates for you on a bunch of simmering issues. There's healthcare, which is hurtling towards some self-imposed deadlines in Congress. There's President Trump's budget proposal freshly out this morning, large parts of which may not be adopted, but would shed light on his White House priorities. There's the Supreme Court, with nominee Neil Gorsuch's confirmation hearings coming up. We'll talk about all that and more this week. Very quickly, before I give you the data points at the foundation of this week's episode, remember, please email us if you have questions at nerdcast@politico.com. And please subscribe, rate us, and write a written review of the Nerdcast, if you have time, on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. All right, the data points. First up this week, we're going to talk about two numbers from a bipartisan poll conducted for Fox News, 47% and 35%. Those are President Trump's approval ratings on two different issues. First, the economy, 47%, and then healthcare, 35%. And it says something about why the healthcare bill is running into some trouble. Next up, the number 8. That's how many Democratic senators the GOP needs to swing to avoid a filibuster on Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch, who will be back at the center of attention in confirmation hearings next week. And lastly, we will talk about the number 3. That data point is the number of National Security Council staffers who have left so far in the young Trump administration. And here's who we'll talk about it with. Greetings to White House correspondent Eli Stokels.
Hey, Scott.
Hello, Chief Investigative Reporter Ken Vogel.
That's me. Hi.
And a big welcome to White House correspondent Annie Carney.
Hello.
All right, here are the first of those data points that I just mentioned. We're starting off today with 47 and 35. Those are President Donald Trump's approval ratings on particular issues in the latest Fox News poll, which is conducted by a bipartisan pair of pollsters. Got all sorts of questions in there, like job approval, direction of the country, so on and so forth. And in this poll, voters say 47% to 44% that they approve of how Trump is handling the economy. But on healthcare, only 35% approve and 55% disapprove, basically gap between good and really bad. And we've seen this in a few other polls. We've seen this on issue after issue. So, Eli, what does this tell us about the state of the healthcare fight in Congress and the Trump administration's involvement in it?
Well, it tells you that it's a bit of a mess. It's a bit of a mess right now. And it's hard to know if it gets cleaned up or if it's going to just be a mess. I mean, I talked to a pretty senior Republican Senate staffer over the last couple of days, and they said, this could all be posturing, all this back and forth, everybody having different problems with the bill just on the Republican side. And he said it could just be posturing. This thing could already be baked in. It's probably either already passed or already dead. We just don't know it yet. It was an interesting comment to me because there is this sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't sort of problem with this. It is a very difficult thing to do. They overpromised for the last 6 years that they would repeal this thing, that it would be easy. All you have to do is elect Republican majorities and we'll get rid of it. And as Sean Spicer might say, everything will be rainbows and unicorns. Not really the case right now, as you see the sausage making beginning on the Hill. And I think, the problem here is you have different factions in the Republican side. And as we've talked about before, it's just not as clear as it used to be in terms of the politics for conservatives. Breitbart is trashing this bill as Paul Ryan care. The White House ostensibly is sort of carrying the water on it. But you saw Donald Trump go out and do a rally last night or Wednesday night in Nashville saying at the end of the speech, getting around to talking about health care reform and we have to repeal this and talking about it very broadly. And talking specifically about the House bill, but it didn't seem like his heart was really in it, right? It wasn't what he wanted to talk about first. He spent a little bit of time talking about it on the plane coming back. He said, you know what? We may have to just mix it up. We may have to figure it out, but we're going to pass something. Something is not necessarily the Paul Ryan bill. And so if the president is not there saying to all Republicans, get in line, get behind the Paul Ryan bill, at least Paul Ryan on this island right now. And there's no understanding really where the White House really is on that bill, where the concessions are going to be made. And Republican members have to figure out, and it's very difficult to determine if, you take a position on this bill. Is Breitbart going to come after you if you do support it? Is Donald Trump going to come to your district and primary or, threaten to primary you or fight you publicly with his Twitter feed if you don't support it? It's all very unclear. Just a lot of cross signals right now, and I don't know how it gets ironed out.
But something Eli said is so telling, which is reading the Breitbart tea leaves and seeing the knives out at Breitbart in a very aggressive way for Paul Ryan. Of course, this is not necessarily new. Breitbart actively and aggressively supported and encouraged a primary challenger to Paul Ryan in his last run. The guy got absolutely slaughtered. Nonetheless, you saw the signal there. Breitbart wasn't necessarily on the same page with Paul Ryan, the Republican establishment. You saw it this potential divide or rift becoming inflamed this week when Breitbart published this tape from Ryan on a conference call in October before the election, saying that he was not going to defend Donald Trump, not now, not in the future. And they used it as sort of a jumping off point to go after the healthcare overhaul as Ryan Care. And so you see that signal. Of course, the reason why we're looking at those tea leaves in the first place is because Breitbart was hugely influential in sort of shaping and encouraging the Trump takeover of the GOP. And of course, Steve Bannon, the Trump's leading political guru in the White House, ran Breitbart for years. So there's a reason that we're looking at this stuff, and it is telling that Breitbart is sort of staking this out. Additionally, I have heard from some folks in the White House that this is not, that they are taking their cues from the White House and from Bannon, perhaps. There was a meeting at which the Trump senior advisors with Trump were trying to sell the healthcare overhaul to conservative groups in the White House. One of my sources told me that Kellyanne Conway made a crack about Paul Ryan and about the rollout of the healthcare overhaul, the Obamacare repeal and replace legislation, as being not well rolled out. And Mark Short kind of nodded his head in agreement.
That's Trump's legislative director,
right? While Trump himself and the other senior advisors kind of sat there silently, essentially, my source told me, condoning this swipe at Paul Ryan.
Well, let's zoom out for a second. The reason why this has turned into such a big thing this week is we talked last week. We were awaiting the CBO score, right? The Congressional Budget Office, the nonpartisan kind of budget scorekeeper on the Hill, that came out with their report this week, and it said the House bill is going to cut the deficit by 300 some billion, but it's also going to knock a lot of people off insurance. I think it was 14 million over the first year, 24 million over 10 years. And Annie, this gets into a little bit what we've been talking about already. It's tough to defend, and maybe it gets to a little bit why it waited till the end of Trump's speech in Nashville, why he's been a lot more, seemingly at least in public, a lot more aggressive going after other policy planks, things he wants to achieve, even while this is inflaming Congress.
Right. Well, one of his major campaign promises was that he would repeal and replace Obamacare and that no one would lose their coverage. And now the CBO is saying 24 million people will lose their coverage. And I think we reported, our healthcare reporter, Paul Demko, reported that the White House had its own internal estimate that was even worse. So they've been trying to knock down the CBO number, they were pre-budding that number, but their own numbers are worse. So they know that people will lose their coverage. So last night, Wednesday night at his rally, we saw him return to the campaign trail, which is the environment that he loves best, in front of an adoring crowd. But he took the stage, minutes after the Hawaii judge knocked down his Muslim ban for the second time. So he was taking the stage as two of his major campaign promises are on the rocks. So I don't think he is ready to explain exactly like what happened to the pledge of no one losing their coverage. I also find it interesting that, Pence was making the rounds on the Hill selling the healthcare bill, saying, quote, "This president is ready to put the full weight of his bully pulpit and all of his tools behind the bill." But he was on the bully pulpit on Wednesday night, and he didn't talk about healthcare.
He spent about 5 minutes out of the 35-minute speech, right?
So Pence can say all he wants that Trump's going to be fully behind this. The White House has been not wanting to call it Trump Care, which, Obama didn't want to call it Obamacare either at first, but Trump is the guy who's all about branding. So I think it's notably doesn't want his name on something. So there are some sort of mixed messages coming out of the White House. I don't think we've seen Trump actually pull the full weight of the bully pulpit and all of his tools behind this bill yet.
But Republicans were really so excited that he just gave them a little bit of crumbs and said, he supports the bill and he'll sign it. And that was hardly the full-throated endorsement, as you mentioned. I mean, he spent more time, encouraging the audience in a chant of lock her up when he started talking about Hillary Clinton again. Like, that's where his comfort zone is. That's what he wants to do. It's so evident that he enjoyed the campaign trail more than he enjoys this process of governing. And, this is sort of why governing is hard.
At the same time, I mean, we started talking about poll numbers. Like, this is what he needs, a legislative win. I don't know why.
Or even a win in the courts with the travel
ban. Right, he needs
ban.
A win. So, like, if this bill fails, I think it's a failure for Donald Trump.
Well, I think he's going to get probably a win with Neil Gorsuch, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But I think you're right. Legislatively, he needs a win. But I think part of the calculation for Bannon and for Donald Trump, and part of the reason why we may not see him really put the full weight of his bully pulpit behind this and give that full-throated endorsement of this bill is because he doesn't want to be tied to something that is a loser, okay? And so he's going to always sort of hedge his bets. He does it on everything. He oftentimes says one thing and then contradicts himself and says the other. He always gives himself that room to go back on something. And so I think, yes, he's pushing for this House bill, but not as emphatically as you might expect. And I think that's because at the end of the day, he knows he can sit here and say, Congress really screwed this up. Congress can't get anything done. You come to town, I'm a businessman. You come to town, you ask them to do something, they can't figure it out. It's terrible. The swamp, that's right. And there are Republicans very involved in 2018 races who are nervous about the failure of this and how it will impact Republican incumbents because they don't have Donald Trump's sort of invisibility cloak or nonsense, shield or whatever, where he can just do and say things that other politicians can't. And people who have run and been reelected for years, for 6 years, saying we're going to get rid of Obamacare, if they don't do it, I think they feel like that can come back at them. And I think Trump believes that too and doesn't really care because he'll still be there.
And on the flip side, Ken, you can see some echoes of 2009, 2010 here in the way that Democrats have immediately latched on to the worst numbers in this health care bill and have started beating Republicans over the head with it already, right? There's danger for them on both sides.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of parallels with the original Obamacare Affordable Care Act push that, took a lot of time, took a lot of political capital from President Obama, from Democrats who at that time controlled both chambers at the beginning of the debate. By the end of the debate, they didn't have the veto-proof majority in the Senate because of Ted Kennedy's passing. But nonetheless, it really set back all the other items on President Obama's legislative agenda, and we're seeing some echoes of that. I want to go back, though, to something Annie raised about the travel ban, which actually dovetails with what Eli was talking about Trump wanting to assign blame and wanting to point out these reasons why he's not getting the win. He attacked the judge in the Ninth Circuit in Hawaii as an activist judge, and I thought so tellingly he admitted, this is something that we had speculated a lot about on this program and in our pages, about this question as to whether Trump would be willing to pull back that first travel ban executive order and revise it so it would be more court-proof. He admitted that he didn't want to do that. He said, I think we ought to go back to the first one and go all the way, which is what I wanted to do in the first place. That, I think, could actually hinder the administration's ability to defend this ban by saying that, no, he wanted those things that that the judge found objectionable in the first place, that this next judge or on the revised executive order still found to be problematic. You know, they're using his words and his sort of loose lips against him. These, the lawyers who are challenging this travel ban, and I think he could have given them some more fodder last night.
Absolutely, I was reporting on this last night, and immigrant lawyers and activists were basically saying, just like, keep talking. You're making our case for us.
Here's the statement I just found in the email from someone who's the head of the National Immigration Law Center. And the quote is, Trump's statements tonight, he should just continue talking because he's making our arguments for us.
Well,
the case for ill intent, I think, is part of it. That he's basically saying he preferred the first one. The second one was just an attempt, a watered-down attempt to do the same thing.
Watered down. He actually used those words.
Yeah. Annie, I want to jump back into something, another thing that you mentioned a couple minutes ago as we start to wrap up this segment. You were talking about how Trump needs a win to show for some of the promises he's made. And he's put forward a lot of executive orders, and he's been able to do a lot of that in his first month and a half. But there's only so much you can do. And at some point, the big problem he's running into so far is that a lot of the other stuff he wants to do is running into those other obstacles within the government. You've got the courts with the travel ban that we just talked about. You've got Congress with healthcare. And now we see today releasing the White House releasing its budget for 2018. You see again yet more places where Trump and his campaign rhetoric are kind of running into obstacles within the Republican Party in terms of the big cuts that are up for some of these agencies and the specific priorities that are outlined in this budget.
Well, this budget is more a political tool and a messaging tool than anything else. I think it's a wish list. It's not going to happen, but preliminary budgets usually are. I think it's more an attempt by Trump to signal to his base, you know, what his priorities are and what where his heart is. One thing that I was talking to like a smart Democrat last week who said, you know, this budget isn't stupid from a political point of view for Donald Trump. Like you put all the money in defense, you whack the EPA and the NEA and Democrats will run and defend these programs, the arts, and the Republicans portray the Democrats as the party defending like the weakest real estate. And that
the weakest political real estate.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that this is really Trump being able to tell their voters what they need to communicate. So, I mean, the stories I read about the budget described it as dead on arrival. But if you look at it as a messaging tool, it's actually not stupid.
That's a great point, Annie, and it's actually a great segue into our next segment that I want to talk about. As Eli mentioned before, Neil Gorsuch, the Supreme Court nominee, is up for a confirmation hearing next week, and our next data point is the number 8. And that's the number of Senate Democrats that Gorsuch will have to sway onto his side in order to avoid getting stuck in a filibuster in the Senate. And now, Eli, we were talking a little bit about this before the show, and the Gorsuch has kind of gotten swamped almost in all this other news that's going on, whether it's healthcare in Congress or investigations or the travel ban kind of coming back up. And now all of a sudden he's going to be in the spotlight after really skating through the last few weeks under the radar next week.
Yeah, Washington, D.C. is certainly still very swampy in terms of a news environment, probably swampier than ever. And that has sort of allowed Gorsuch to just kind of go do his business on the Hill, prepare for this hearing, and be kind of the forgotten man. I think the Trump administration is eager for these hearings because they look at his nomination and at the likelihood of his confirmation as a win, a bright spot, an almost slam dunk win at this point, just based on I think reluctance that they are sensing from Democrats to really force Republicans to use the nuclear option right away. And also just because, you know, you mentioned the number 8. That's how many votes they need. Well, the other number is 10. There are 10 Democratic senators in red states that Trump won, right? And so are they going to oppose this guy when the alternative, if they take this guy down, is what? I mean, you know, Justice Pryor? Like, come on. So I think at this point he's been successful. You're starting to see a little bit of whatever sort of oppo hits that the Democrats have been waiting to drop. We saw the New York Times on Wednesday night in this Charlie Savage story headlined, Neil Gorsuch helped defend disputed Bush-era terror policies. So you're starting to see, you know, some of the things that the Democrats might like to use to plant in the media, to sow doubt, to put pressure on Gorsuch. But I talked to a Republican Senate person who's doing some counts, some head counts a couple days ago. And he said, you know, I think it's not a question of whether he gets 60. It's a question of can he get closer to 70.
I just feel like this is like a show for the Democrats. They have to put up a fight. But like no one thinks this guy isn't getting confirmed, right? I mean, it's the most functional aspect of the Trump administration so far. He's qualified for the job. He pleases conservatives. Trump loves to say, like, he was on my list of judges that I put out during the campaign. See, I told you I'd pick from this list, and I did. It's campaign promise upheld. And, I mean, the only thing that Democrats can, like, retaliate for holding up Garland, but I just, in my own head, I've just been assuming that Gorsuch is obviously going to be a Supreme Court justice soon. But one thing that with the travel ban, if it goes to the Supreme Court, this could incentivize the Democrats to hold this up longer to prevent Gorsuch from being in place to break a 4-4 tie ruling on the ban if it goes to the Supreme Court.
Quote Moses Malone, faux, faux, faux. But actually, to Eli's point on the Annie makes a great point about the feeder of it. Democrats have to get worked up. This is the way Washington works. Like anytime there's a Supreme Court nomination battle, you know, people the sides, even if there's dissent within the parties, they sort of unite and go to their separate corners and they fight out their. You know, they use the Supreme Court battle as like a proxy war for like all their social issues and all their, you know, their grievances over past Supreme Court cases. And so, you know, they kind of have to. Democrats have to do this. But I've actually been surprised by the tepid nature of their opposition. They're not the big donors aren't pouring tons of money into groups to spend a lot on ads and going after him. You don't really see a concerted push. Even the Oppo, as Eli mentioned, is kind of being received with a little bit of like a meh. You know, you mentioned a Charlie Savage story on Gorsuch's role in defending Bush era travel policy. There was another big story that I found fascinating about Gorsuch's connection to this conservative billionaire Phil Anschlitz, who owns the Weekly Standard and the Washington Examiner, conservative publications here in Washington, and it had a headline: Neil Gorsuch has web of ties to secretive billionaire. You'd think people would get like super fired up about that, but even that was met with sort of a collective shrug. So it just kind of goes to show you that with the existential threat that Democrats see in Donald Trump, they're not necessarily getting as worked up about the normal sort of traditional battles. I don't know if they're saving their fodder, though, either. Like, I've been surprised as well that there haven't been major protests, organized protests from the left at some of these rallies that Trump has done. Like, where are you? Where are the liberal activists who were so beside themselves about Donald Trump? They came out in huge numbers, obviously, on the day after the inauguration for the Women's March. Since then, there just really hasn't been a ton of energy on the left in the sort of opposition to Trump that I have seen from the activist base.
In terms of the court, though, I don't know. Maybe they're like this is not the judge that will change the makeup of the court. This is the Scalia replacement. Maybe they're saving their real objections for the one that will actually change the makeup of the court, which will be the next.
But this is when they should be most fired up. Like it's, you know, people like the fundraisers talk about like it's easiest to raise money in opposition and it's easiest to raise money in opposition when you're just new to that opposition. And I just don't see a ton of energy. You know, it'd be interesting. The Democracy Alliance, a club of major liberal donors, is meeting in Washington next week, I believe, or in the coming days. And I'll be watching that to see just how much these donors are fired up because, again, on the Gorsuch battle, which is where they would usually come out, fall into line, write the fat checks to whip up opposition, I don't see a ton of it.
You know, Ken, I wonder – that's a really interesting point about the engagement from the big donors on the Democratic side because I think
– But the activists too.
Well, so I think there's an interesting example on that. It's that – I think it's popping up, just maybe not in the traditional ways that we would expect. There's so Jason Chaffetz, the Republican member of Congress from Utah, made a statement a few weeks ago about comparing the cost of iPhones and health insurance and suggesting that some people don't buy health insurance because they would rather buy a shiny new iPhone. This upset a lot of people. And we saw in about a week after that, a Democratic doctor running against him in Utah raised $450,000 online, which is an enormous amount for a House candidate. That would be a really good three-month take. But I think the other point, this is not a battleground district. Jason Chaffetz almost couldn't possibly lose that district. And so the money is kind of – and the activism is popping up. But I don't know if it's being directed necessarily.
Yeah, you know, and I take your point actually, and I should note and your comments made me realize, of course, that Chaffetz did have a bunch of people turn out for a town hall. And there was a string of town halls that Republicans had during the recently concluded recess where there were a lot of critics who came out to voice opposition. So there is some energy there in the base as to whether it's being properly channeled or not. You know, if it's showing up at a Jason Chaffetz town hall or pouring money into a Jason Chaffetz opponent, then it's not necessarily it's the sort of passion money, not the smart money, because as you said, he's not going to lose. That said, I rescind my point
extend.
And put out another executive executive summary for the critics to pounce on.
I mean, politics is often about opportunistically raising money, but it also has to be about a broader long-term strategy and some pragmatism on Democrats' part. And if you – I mean, the progressive base is already really ginned up about Donald Trump. They're up in arms about the travel ban, healthcare. They're outraged today about the budget. I mean, there's a lot of outrage, but there's a limit on that and where you can direct it. And I think Neil Gorsuch has not been the target of a lot of that, because even though people understand he's a, you know, very, very hardcore conservative, you know, they understand what he is and they expected something like that from Donald Trump. I think that in terms of the broader, you know, if you incite a lot of, you know, passion and opposition from the base strategically around this nomination, then you're putting your Democratic senators, including the ones who are the most vulnerable next time, in this, you know, you're adding to the pressure on them. You're potentially letting the train leave the station on rules changes in the Senate that could be detrimental down the road. So there may be a larger strategy and understanding that, you know, there's enough outrage on the left without turning Gorsuch into, you know, taking Gorsuch that fight to the mattress.
And he's also not like a great target. It's not just that like these Oppo stories that we're talking about fall far short of like the proverbial pubic hair on the Diet Coke, Clarence Thomas, Anita God. Hill stuff. It's also that like on the actual substance that of the issues that Democrats tend to get worked up about,
right,
there's not a lot of there. Money and politics. You know, he has one ruling where it's like unclear. He actually sided for, you know,
You've talked in the past. You can read it both ways.
Right. Yeah. So it was a contributions limit case, or maybe it was a spend. Anyway, it was a case that like he sort of ruled to strike down campaign finance rules, but they were kind of regarded as flawed rules in the first place. That even the left sort of, even the campaign finance reform community regarded these rules as flawed. So, you know, it's you don't see like a great target for them to channel all their frustrations into. That said, I still think it's notable that there hasn't been a whole huge concerted campaign to take him down.
I thought it was very savvy, politically savvy, when he said he found it disheartening and demoralizing that Trump was attacking federal judges. I don't know
totally
if that was a plan or if he really is just a man who respects the law and didn't like that. But I think that I heard from
– or maybe both.
Yeah. But I heard from Democrats who were really impressed by that statement that came like days after Trump nominated him and made him look like a reasonable judge.
He went into Dick Durbin's office, and I assume he's done this with a lot of Democrats, is the charm offensive is real. He went in and told Durbin that the person he respects and wants to carry himself as a Supreme Court nominee is Merrick Garland. He said, if I can be half the nominee that Merrick Garland was, you know, I'll be doing okay. And he's pushing the right buttons with the Democrats. He's saying, you know what? You might not agree with a lot of my positions, but personally – you can see that I'm a decent guy. I respect you, right? He's not a like stick a finger in your eye kind of fighter like Trump is. And so I just think he hasn't generated the kind of opposition from Democrats in the Senate and also just from the country, right? The people who are jamming phone lines on Capitol Hill, they're not mostly, I don't think, calling about Neil Gorsuch. They're calling about other things, and there are plenty of other things to call about.
Let's move here from, again, like Annie said, perhaps the most organized part of the Trump administration to the rest of the Trump administration. The data point that we're citing for our final segment this week is 3. And that's the number of National Security Council staffers who have been removed since the start of the Trump administration about 2 months ago. And that includes, obviously, former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who we've discussed on previous episodes. Some in the White House are blaming unseen forces out to get them for some of these departures. And Ken, I want to start with you on this. You and Alex Eisenstadt just wrote a big story on the broader culture of paranoia inside this administration in its early days. What's happening here? And can you tell us a little bit about how this is affecting the White House's governing work?
Yeah, sure. There's an intense paranoia, first of all, that is gripping the Trump administration in the White House, in the agencies, and it's really gumming up the works of government. I mean, it's not the most functional administration that we've seen in recent memory, but this, I think, is making it worse. And it's there's sort of 3 buckets of paranoia that Eisenstadt and I identified that I think are causing these problems. One is this fear that everyone is out to get everyone on the Trump team. These are Trump appointees in the White House.
Some,
Right. Well, that's a good point. I mean, I should say in each of these cases, there is like not necessarily enough to like corroborate and be like, oh, yeah, this is a totally valid concern, nor is there enough to say to completely brush it off and say these are unfounded concerns. So there's degrees in there. The idea that Trump aides are out to get other Trump aides, that's the one that is sort of most well-founded. In fact, they are out to get each other. One of the sources who we quote in this story says, it's not paranoia if they really are out to get you, and they are out to get each other. So that's one. Then sort of sliding down the scale, there's the idea that like Obama appointees, either political appointees who have embedded in the government, who remained on in the Trump administration, or career civil servants who go back any number of years who do not like Trump and perhaps you're for the days of Obama are causing problems, are leaking stories, et cetera. I think there's definitely a little bit of there as well. And then the most sort of controversial that people think is sort of the most conspiratorially minded tinfoil hat, black helicopter theory is this idea of the deep state, this group of career intelligence officers who are either leaking classified information or using the security clearance process to come after Trump aides. And while there's been a lot of guffawing, I think, particularly in the media about this, my colleague Eliana Johnson, Holly Tuzzi, another colleague who have written about the NSC, the National Security Council, actually have seen some evidence that the CIA in particular has it out for some of the Trump appointees to the National Security Council. It started with Flynn. He had a deep skepticism for the CIA that he has articulated through years and years and years. And you saw Trump kind of internalize some of that during the campaign, during the transition.
Putting
intelligence in quotes, minimizing the intelligence community's findings that Russia, not only hacked Democratic email accounts, but did it to try to help him. And as such, there is some concern that Flynn's ouster, which came as a result of leaks from the national security and intelligence agencies about his calls with the Russian ambassador, that was the CIA's effort to get back at them. And some of the folks who have been forced off of that, most of the folks who have been forced off the NSC are in fact Flynn loyalists who, my sources tell me, do share Flynn's skepticism for the CIA. Now, whether that's the deep state or the CIA just protecting their own or legitimate policy differences, I'm not ready to make a conclusion necessarily, but that I think is what is behind these concerns, this paranoia about the deep state in particular.
And this is again, the NSC is the agency that's the office that's tasked with coordinating all of the national security apparatus of the government, right, and feeding recommendations to the White House.
And it's critically important, and it's also as a result of that, it does. A lot of the folks on the NSC are detailees from these other agencies. So we had another story, Eliana and I, this week about another guy, the National Security Council's intelligence director, a young guy, 30 years old, who was also a Flynn appointee, who the CIA folks who deal with the NSC had raised concerns about this guy, so much so that H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, head of the National Security Council, actually told this guy on last Friday, hey, we're going to move you to a different position, sidelining him. This guy appealed to Jared Kushner and Steve Bannon, with whom he had forged a relationship during the transition. They took it to Trump, and Trump essentially overruled McMaster. So in that one episode, you see both the deep state concerns and why they have them, that this guy was sort of targeted by the CIA, and you see the infighting because you have Kushner and Bannon essentially taking to Trump to overrule McMaster.
And this stuff is taking up time. It's taking up time that would otherwise be used to work on things, right,
yeah,
Annie?
There's also another element that I haven't actually put in a story yet, but I'll just say it here, is that there is a tension between Trump loyalists and people who are now staffing the agencies. Like, I've heard that they had a system where they were going to put like these Trump loyalists in the agencies for the first 120 days of the administration. Those people are now being blocked from sitting in on meetings at the EPA and other agencies. And those people think that they're the only ones that really understand Trump and have his interests in mind. And now they're being blocked by the
Obama. Yeah, and they believe that it's there are Obama appointees or Obama holdovers at these agencies who are trying to undermine it. Those people get it from both sides because the White House doesn't fully trust the people at the agencies who are not the cabinet-level right. people, nor do some of the career types who are just hostile to Trump. So you see really a cauldron of pressure, and you can understand why this paranoia is there.
We reported a story yesterday in the West Wing of – that's sort of related of how all of the top lieutenants of Trump's administration go to every meeting and every photo op with the president. And it's actually surprised a lot of people in the White House. Like Trump met in the Oval Office with big right-wing groups that fund the Freedom Caucus who are objecting to Paul Ryan's health care bill. And they were – someone who went to that meeting said he was shocked that Kellyanne was there, Bannon was there, Priebus was there, Jared was there. Mulvaney was there, and he said, like, usually when you come to the White House for a meeting, you meet with one person, but the gang's all there.
And what's the reason for that?
And the reason for that is that they, first of all, because of the way the White House is set up with rival power centers, they don't know what will be said about them if they're not in the meeting. They don't know that they will know what happened in the meeting, that anyone will give them a readout if they're not there. So they're out of like a defensive crouch of needing to protect themselves.
They don't want to get knifed.
Right? There's a word for this. It's called dysfunction. Okay. And that's what we're talking about. If you step back from all of this, what you see, I mean, there's the self-fulfilling prophecy aspect to all of this. I mean, you have a guy running the federal government like he ran his family business. It was a family business, very small, very insular. And that's how they're trying to run a federal government that just cannot be run functionally in that way. And you talk about this deep state perception, and that term is a very evocative term that for readers of Breitbart and in conservative circles will, you know, it will encapsulate everything that they think, the antipathy toward the Obama people, the sense that they're under attack from the media and from the mainstream and from government and all these things that feed into this paranoia and sort of conspiracy theory, you know, warmth to conspiracy theories that already exist out there. But Trump always provokes these reactions that he then gets upset about. He gets upset, you know, he says crazy things, he insults people, and then somebody comes back at him and he says, why are you being so mean to me? You know, he's bristling at this dysfunction right now. He's upset that there are Obama holdovers across the government who are coming after him and leaking to undercut him. And, you know, that does not take into account, like Ken said, all the things that Trump said on the campaign trail and after being elected and after being inaugurated to sort of stick a finger in the eye of the CIA and to question, you know, whether they're actually on the – I mean he sort of picked that fight and now this is a result of it. As far as their transition goes and the staffing issues across the government, you know, they're not going to take the blame themselves for why there are so many Obama holdovers, why the confirmation process has been slowed down, why they haven't put forth nominees for most of the top jobs at defense and state and other agencies, why people at some of these agencies that they want to abolish, like the EPA, are keeping the Trump people out of meetings. I wonder why. But, you know, when you go back to the failure to fill a lot of these positions and the fact that there are so many Obama people across government, it's because the transition was a disaster. Chris Christie, they gave it to him, obviously, because they didn't think they were going to win. Let's give Chris something to do. Then they took it away from him. Then a lot of the people staffing the transition, Rick Dearborn and others, left to go do other things. And none of these – like the job of staffing government – just fell by the wayside. It was never done. The vetting wasn't done on major cabinet nominees. There were so many shortcuts taken here and such a short-sightedness to the whole thing. I mean, you've heard Trump say, I don't know if we need to really fill all these positions. What do these people do? I don't really get it, right? It appeals to people who sit there and ideologically don't like the idea of a big government, but we're seeing the dysfunction that is the result of that approach. And you can defend it publicly all you want. You can blame it on other people. But you have to step back and understand that this is something that they have created for themselves.
Yeah, and you talk about the vacancies and the slowness in filling some of these positions. Certainly all those things that you said are part of it. Another part of it, I think, is that they are so on guard for allowing in people who were never mm-hmm. Trump, anti-Trump, or even cool to Trump, even people who supported Trump's primary opponents because they think that they will be yet another source of leaks. So they're paranoid, sort of preemptively paranoid. And that's one of the ways in which it is causing them difficulties in sort of keeping government moving and creating an administration. You know, Eli mentioned that this is this is different than running a family business or different than running a campaign. But some of the same culture did exist on the campaign. It did exist during the business. I mean, one of the concerns on the campaign, people were so paranoid, they thought that their offices in Trump Tower were being bugged. And of course, Trump does have a long history of surveillance and setting up sophisticated surveillance systems at his properties. And he does have a history of building organizations where there is infighting and where there are rivalries. And he does have a history himself of embracing these sort of conspiracy theories. And you don't have to look a whole lot further than his claim on Twitter that Obama wiretapped his campaign headquarters to see both an example of the paranoia that trickles down and an example of how that paranoia can be detrimental to the functioning of government. That claim on Twitter came the week that they were trying to roll out the Republican replacement to Obamacare, and it stomped all over the message. So they were, I think, they sort of shot themselves in the foot. Trump shot himself in the foot by taking attention away from what other – I mean, you could quibble and say maybe it wouldn't have been that good of a rollout anyway because Republicans are at odds, but it certainly didn't help.
He blamed the media. Last night he blamed the media for stepping on his narrative.
Like with the Jeff Sessions controversy, so he was distracting from that. I mean, there's always like a million – like this Trump tweets to distract and tweets to this and tweets to that. Like he tweets because he read something and
he live tweets Fox and Friends in the morning. That's
like,
what
he's
doing.
I don't think there's I hate all the strategy behind why Trump tweets.
Right.
But I do think that
– shooting down the conventional wisdom here on Nerdcast.
That's right. I do think that this like litmus test of loyalty – and were you with him, is really shooting themselves in the foot or cutting off their own nose to spite their face and is holding them back. Like they should get over that they won and want to be successful now.
Lock her up.
All right. Well, I think that's as good a place as any to wrap up for the week. Thank you all for a great conversation. Annie, thank you for joining us.
Sure.
Ken, thank you.
Fun time as always.
And Eli, thank you as always.
Thanks, Scott.
And, of course, thank you very, very much to our listeners, as always. Remember, please send in your questions, if you have them, to nerdcast@politico.com and subscribe and rate us on iTunes or your favorite podcast app if you haven't already. Also, thank you again, as always, to our excellent executive producer, Bridget Mulcahy, our illustrator, Bill Cookman, and Nerdcast researcher and Politico producer, Zach Montalaro. Take care, listeners. We will talk to you again next week. Thank you.